Well, good morning. My name is Zach Thompson. I'm on staff here at Calvary Bible Church, but you probably don't see me all that often because I'm normally at our Thornton campus. But it is a joy to get to go to the different campuses that we have. It's one of my favorite times of the year. It's a personal delight for me. It's full of reminders of there's people praying for us who don't even attend our campus. And I get to, once again, be surrounded by people who are as excited about what God is doing in the city of Thornton as I am. Now, I will confess that my love for being here was really put to the test last year. And I want to be clear on this. That has nothing to do with any of you all. You all were great. But I was here on Father's Day last year, and I was tasked with preaching on God the Father. I mean, perfect timing, right? Not so much. It was also the same week that we had a follow-up appointment with our fertility clinic. I should say it was the second fertility clinic that we had gone to in the 7 years of Emily and I trying to become parents. And at that appointment, we were told that we had a less than 1% chance of conceiving naturally and a less than 5% chance of an IUI ever working out for us. So it was an awful time. I was here smiling at dads, talking about God the Father, all while saying almost like a mantra over and over in my head, "Yeah, but you'll never be one." It was a really difficult time. Well, anyways, here's a picture of our son, Everett. I was hesitant to bring it up for a couple of reasons. One, I don't like making myself the focus of attention. And yeah, the guy in front of a few hundred people on stage doesn't like attention. But there's a difference between what I'm up here to do, which is, hey, let's look at what the Bible says together, and hey, everyone, let's look at my life. But the second reason why I was hesitant is I know there's plenty of people who still don't have a picture they can put up. And we've met a lot of folks over the 7 years of us trying that still are waiting for direction, who still are hoping or have given up hope. And they say when they hear our story, the same thing that we said all those years, but why not us? And I don't want to add to that. I do know it's so much easier to say on this side of things, but I know what God was teaching me in those 7 years of waiting, that he is still a good and perfect father, even if I never get to become one. But I do bring up this because so many of you in this room have been such a great support to us, who have been praying for us, who have been with us in the difficulty, and so you very much so deserve to be with us in the joy. But I also bring this up because Everett's story all throughout is coded in our topic for this morning. We're in this series that we're calling Formed, looking at these practices of Christianity, these habits that we have that help shape us, that form us to be more and more like Jesus. And today we're looking at two of those practices that are given to us for the times of waiting and for the times of rejoicing in this life. And those practices are fasting and feasting. Two practices that sound very much so like opposites, and yet they're interconnected. They're woven together in so many different ways. For one reason, they're often neglected or misunderstood by many modern Christians. There's, for some, the neglect of fasting. It's just not something that we do. I mean, maybe it's for the super elite Christians or skinny people, but I just can't give up food. No. And then there's the unspiritualness of feasting. Like, there's a lot of times that we eat a lot. But apart from praying over the meal at the beginning, we don't tend to think of stuffing our face as a spiritual practice that makes us more like Jesus. And yet I think both of these come down to a misunderstanding. It's actually a misunderstanding of how we're made. See, the Bible is clear that we are body and soul, flesh and spirit, not in opposition to each other, but as one person. And so what is good for the body nourishes the soul. And the way that we respond to God is not just with some ethereal spirituality, but we respond to him with everything that we have, and that includes our bodies. See, in the midst of all these other practices that we're learning about in this series, which are so good, but these two in particular, I think, get to the entire person. Because fasting and feasting are physical actions with spiritual intention in which our whole person is formed to be more and more like Jesus. And so let's get into it. We're in Matthew chapter 9, starting in verse 14. If you want to turn with me, whether in print or pixel, or you could follow along with the passage on the screen, I invite you to do that. But we are in Matthew chapter 9, and we'll be returning to this passage throughout. Matthew chapter 9, starting in verse 14. It says, then the disciples of John, so this is John the Baptist, came to him, to Jesus, saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said to them, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch tears away from the garment, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put in old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst and the wine is spilled and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved. So we have a situation where these followers of John the Baptist come to Jesus and say, hey, how come we and all the other religious people are fasting, but your people are not? Instead, your followers are more marked by feasting. And so as we get into these two topics, these two habits that we have, I think it's important that we understand what we're talking about. So what are they really? What are fasting and feasting really? And so we'll start with fasting. In Matthew chapter 9, Jesus says that that he is here. Why are his followers not fasting? Because the bridegroom's here. This is not a time for mourning. This is not a time for fasting. This is a time for celebration. Jesus is here. He's making all things new. Now, there will be a time when he goes away, and his followers will fast then. And that's the place that we're at right now, you and me. Jesus has come. He has made things new. There's no going back to the Old Testament ways and customs anymore. But he says that this is a time that his followers will be marked by fasting, which is what the people of God have always done. Now, there are an insane amount of references to fasting in the Bible. I mean, essentially, it just is pick someone who's following God. There's probably a story in there of them fasting at some point. People would do this regularly, like each and every week, sometimes even twice a week. But they would also fast on special occasions, whether that's an event on the calendar or they had a particular realization of sin in their life, and so they fasted in response to that. People would fast individually, but they would also do so together, as the whole nation of Israel fasted together. Whole churches would fast together at times. And in this overwhelming amount of stories about fasting in the Bible, it's always from food. It's never from things. Sometimes it's food and water, but fasting in the Bible is when God's people intentionally do not eat. Now, there's a trend in the church to where people will fast from something. And often the language of it is, you know, this thing has just been taking a big part of my life, and so I'm going to give it up for a short period of time so that I could focus on God more. And I'm so grateful that people can come to that realization to put steps in place to address it, but it's not fasting. For one reason, whenever there's something in our life that's taking a bigger place than God, that's just called sin. And we don't need a pause from sin. We don't need a break from it. We need to flee from sin. I imagine doing this with someone who's overindulging in alcohol. Like, hey, just take a month off of getting drunk every night. I mean, maybe as a starting point, but the end goal is not a pause or a break. It's a removal. Disagree with me if you want on this point. It's not a hill I'm willing to die on, but I am willing to die on the hill about being pedantic about language. We fast from food. We abstain from other things. The word we're looking for is abstain. Yeah. There's another trend as well to where people give up something, not because it's sinful or wrong or bad or anything like that. It's actually the opposite. It's something that they enjoy, and they do so in a way that doesn't harm others or themselves. And so this is fasted from for God. And two issues here. One, again, that's abstain. Two, why? Why do we think that it's mutually exclusive to have something that we like and to be with God? Like, it's only we can be in his presence when we're miserable? I just don't get it. No, fasting in the Bible is when God's people intentionally do not eat. It's giving up what we need for life. Not something that we like or something that takes an outsized place in our life. It is giving up what we require in a way that we feel it in our entire body. Because when we fast, when we don't eat, that starts to show up in our body. We feel it. Our stomach rumbles. We get really hungry. Some of us get really angry in those times. But we do so. We give up what our body requires as a way to remind us about what our greatest need is. That what we need, even more so than food, is God's presence in our life. Fasting is something that shows up in just about every religion, just about every people group, and yet biblical fasting is something radically different. And that becomes apparent when we look at what do people fast for? I mean, take probably the most famous faster. It'd be Gandhi and his hunger strike. And he was fasting, he was asserting what he wanted to see in his country, which was the fair and just treatment of his fellow countrymen. It's a good thing to want. He was fasting as a way to try to bring that about. Or look at the fastest growing population of fasters today, people who do so intermittently as part of their diet. And what do they fast for? Oh, it's just to see those sweet, sweet gains. It's to have those dramatic before and after pictures. They fast, it's them asserting a desire to lose weight. But biblical fasting is not me trying to assert my ways. It's not me trying to accomplish something. It's not me trying to earn or achieve anything. Fasting is a time that I cut out what I need so I can recognize what my greatest need is. In this world, especially in times of difficulty, we respond in fasting. There's so much that overwhelms or distracts us from God or pulls our attention in different ways. And so we fast and we cut out something we need so that we can recognize what our greatest need is. See, when I started following Jesus, I thought fasting was just a way to supercharge prayer. Hey, you really want something? Well, pray about it. And if you really want something, add fasting to it. Then God's going to have to listen to you, right? Look how serious you are. But fasting is not about me achieving or accomplishing or asserting my ways. It's actually a way of me being changed. That in this time, I'm recognizing my need for God, and that comes with the certainty that he is always with his people. We cut out all else, especially what is most vital, so that we can more clearly see him. Fasting, then, is a response. As we look in the Bible, fasting is a response to just about every trace of brokenness that people have. And in our life, fasting is a response to every trace of brokenness that shows up in our lives. That as we see this difficulty, as we see hardship, as we see what's difficult in life, we fast in response to all. This is why Jesus in Matthew chapter 9 says, when he goes, his followers will fast in that time. Because think about all that we see in this life, all that's difficult, all that's broken, all the trace of sin that's in everything, all that tempts and traps us as we try to follow after him. And so he says, when he leaves, his followers will fast in that time. This place that we are in right now, we are given ample opportunity to respond to the brokenness of this world by fasting. There's an article on the Gospel Coalition that gives this list of ways that fasting is a response, and it gives these prompts, these ideas of what people might fast in response to. The author goes on to say, so we fast because of our sin and the toll that it takes on others. We fast because as long as we're breathing, our sanctification, our growth, us being formed into Jesus' image is not yet complete. We fast because natural disasters ravage the world. We fast because people die of starvation and thirst, lacking the necessities of life. We fast when cancer tears through our bodies or those of our loved ones. We fast because the entire cosmos is groaning for redemption. We fast because Christ has not yet completed the work that he began in a manger. See, as long as there's brokenness in this world, as long as there's brokenness in our lives, we respond to that by fasting. But what does the Bible talk about even more so than fasting? I mean, we said it's all over. God's people fast. That's what they do. But what does God call his people to do even more so than fast? Oh, they feast. I think of Leviticus chapter 23, where it's this entire chapter where God is commanding the Israelites to keep this series of feasts. And it starts with the Sabbath, this weekly occurrence. Thomas talked about it 2 weeks ago. This is seen as a feast done every single week in this way, But then there's also the Passover, which is called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or the Feast of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Trumpets. There's the Day of Atonement, which is fascinating because it starts off as a fast, people responding to the sin that they see in their lives, but then it ends as a feast in the recognition and assurance that God is the one who forgives sins. And then finally, there is the Feast of Booths. So six annual feasts and one that was to be done every single week. I mean, still think God doesn't care about the joy of his people? He commands them to feast and feast often. And this idea continues with Jesus as well. In Matthew chapter 9, the followers of John the Baptist come up to him and say, "Why aren't you people fasting? You are more marked by feasting." And Jesus says, "Because the bridegroom's here. You can't mourn when the bridegroom's here. I am here. I am making things new. This is a time of celebration. This is a time to feast." Elsewhere, Jesus is accused of being a glutton and a drunkard. I mean, it's obviously not true, but there's a little bit of fire to that smoke because he's always eating. He's constantly with people at meals. He is regularly at feasts. And that is because feasting is a spiritual practice. Again, we are body and soul. So what is good for the body nourishes the soul. But more so than that, where fasting is a response to all that's broken in this world, feasting is an opportunity to remember. Feasting is a remembrance, a reminder that everything that we have comes from God, that every good gift comes from above. And so when we feast, we recognize that God has provided everything for us. And so the way that we rejoice in God's provision, the way that we rejoice in God, is by feasting. Now, there's some obvious examples of what this might look like in our life. Feasting is one that we might do already. There's plenty of holidays that we have as people where we eat quite a bit. But this is also to be a regular occurrence, a regular reminder of our life that we rejoice in what God has given to us. I don't know about you, but I have a habit of including little treats throughout my week, little parts of joy throughout my week. One of the things that we look forward to as a family every single week is we get breakfast burritos on Saturday. Breakfast burritos are a gift of grace and a reminder that God cares about us. And so we get to rejoice in that on Saturday mornings. Also, whenever we're going out to a new place for dinner, I put it on my calendar, and every time I see that on my calendar, I start to get excited through the week. I'm excited to have something delicious, to have something new. Or when I'm out and about running errands, and it's a bit of a drag, like, I mean, I'm already out, so I might as well pick up something, and I'll grab a cold brew or a boba to make it a bit more of an enjoyable time. And we have these moments of including bits of joy throughout our life, and they can be so good for us, body and soul, when we don't cut God out of that process. The idea is that as we feast in abundance or excellence or both, we do so recognizing that God is the one who's provided us with everything. But we also don't cut other people out of the process as well. Feasting is an opportunity for us to be generous towards other people, to be inclusive, to draw people in that we might not otherwise relate to. One of the things that's warned about with feasting is not to overindulge. That's where it can go too far. And what's a great way to prevent against that? Sharing the food with other people. But as we do so, as we feast now, we do so with our eye on the greatest feast. That is no coincidence. The culmination of human history comes when we are joined together, seeing Jesus face to face at a feast. Feasting and fasting are connected. Not just because they're about food, but they are two sides of the same coin. The regular habits throughout the life of Christians now, as we navigate through the good and the bad, the rejoicing and the waiting, we do so by fasting and feasting. But also the way that we prepare for feasting, the one that might come a little bit easier for us, the way that we prepare to feast is by fasting. And I mean that both figuratively and literally. So figuratively, we best enjoy the reminders of God's provision when we're feasting, when we remember how he's faithfully guided us through difficulty when we're fasting. And the way, literally, that we prepare for feasting is by not filling our day up full of food. I mean, how often do we want to eat a big, rich dinner if we've been snacking all day long? But feasting and fasting are connected in Matthew chapter 9 as well. Jesus says when he goes away, his followers will fast. And that's the place that we are right now. And so we fast now, we build this as a habit that shapes us, that forms us over time in this time of waiting for Jesus' return. But Jesus is not fully gone. He's not removed. He's not aloof. He is the one working in our lives to change us. And he is coming back, and he's doing so at a feast. And so we feast now. And that's a practice that, done over time, it shapes us and guides us and forms us to be more like him. And so why should we do these two? Why should feasting and fasting be part of our life? Why should we do them now? Now, hopefully we've seen some reasons why we should throughout our time so far, but I'll spell out three specific ways as to why we should do them. Now, first, the Bible commands us to. And we see that, Matthew chapter 9. Jesus says, when he goes, his followers will fast. But there's a number of places that we can go to where we see this command for the people of God to be people who fast and feast. And we don't even have to leave the words of Jesus to see those things. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 16 through 18, it says twice in this passage, twice, when you fast, and then gives instruction about what Jesus' followers are to do when they fast. Now, I want to draw your attention to that first word there. It says when. It doesn't say if. It says when, and then instruction on what fasting looks like. See, there's no optional route here. There's no plan B. There's just instruction about what fasting as a Christian looks like, because it's a given that Jesus' followers will be fasting. And the same thing is said about feasting. No, literally, the same thing is said about feasting. In Luke chapter 14, 12 through 14, it says, when you give a dinner or banquet, and then skip down to the next verse, when you give a feast, and then instruction to be generous when you give a feast. See, the idea is Jesus is not just saying what his followers might do, he is saying what they will do. And his followers are people who fast and feast. Second reason why we should do them is because Jesus did. In Matthew chapter 4 and its parallels, Jesus fasts for 40 days in the wilderness, remaining faithful where Israel did not in the Old Testament. And then, as we've said, his ministry is centered around meals. He's constantly at feasts. He's even accused of being too into feasts. We talk about how this is a series, how we were formed to be more like Jesus. Well, what's Jesus like? Well, he spent his time fasting and feasting. So if we're to be like him, we're going to do what he did. And to that end, fasting and feasting both help form us. They are practices done over time where we remember God's presence in our life, that we rejoice in his provision to us, that as we experience these practices, as they become habits for us, they shape and guide us to live the life that God's called us to live. And that's why we see these two practices lived out by Christians throughout church history. In fact, in looking it up, there's really only one group of Christians that's not marked by a regular habit of fasting, and that would be the American church over the last 100 years or so. Everyone else in church history, we see them fast and then follow that up with feasting. One of the things that we say, one of the ways that we say we can use church history is that if we ever find ourselves alone, that we stumble across some new way of thinking or some new practice after, 2,000 years of God faithfully providing for and guiding for his church and caring for it and protecting it, that if we ever stumble on this side of it with some sort of new practice, we should reevaluate that practice because we're doing things wrong. And so how do we do this? How do we fast and feast in our lives now? Because these are hard to do. There's a reason why it's not part of our life, because they're difficult. It's hard to not eat when things are hard, and it's difficult to remember God is our provider when all we see is a bounty of food in front of us. And so I want to be as practical as I can. I want to give practical steps so that we can not necessarily make this easier. It's still going to be difficult. I'm not going to give false promises, but so we can at least have the same starting point as we try to have feasting and fasting be a regular habit in our life. So we'll start with fasting. And there's two sides of fasting. Fasting as a regular habit and fasting in response to specific events. And they are connected. It's not as though they're different things. The way we prepare, it's not going to be instinctual for us to fast when things are hard, when there's a natural disaster or tragedy strikes our community. We're not going to have that instinct to fast if we're not building that instinct throughout our weeks. But it's not as though we just fast now to prepare for emergencies. Hey, don't eat right now because things are going to be terrible soon and you need to be ready. That's not a great selling point. But there's also plenty in our life, in our week, to regularly respond to in fasting and to fast in a way that we do so regularly. And so let's talk about how this might be a regular practice for us in this room. Maybe this starts this week by taking one meal Just one time that you would otherwise be eating, and to not eat in that meal and instead use it as a time to remind yourself of what your greatest need is. And as you're doing so, try it again the next week or some other time after that, so that this could be a regular habit of reminding yourself of your need for the presence of God and the realization that he is with you. To strip out what is most vital and to living so that we can recognize what is absolutely vital for us to follow God. Experiment with your week to see where does it make the most sense to do this. But as you're doing so, take care of yourself. Drink lots of water. Maybe as you're starting it out, as you're cutting out a meal, to not cut out calories entirely, but replace it with a juice or something. The idea is to help this be a sustainable and healthy practice for you going forward. Or maybe it is starting with a day. One 24-hour period of not eating to recognize the presence of God and our need for him. And if it's helpful, I would like to share what I did this past week. Now, wait a second. We just read Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus says, when you fast, don't draw attention to yourself. So me showing what I just did, what I did this past week, undoes any spiritual good that comes from fasting, right? It's a reminder that there's so much more that I would like to say on fasting. There's just so much more to touch base on. I had a whole section that I had to cut out that I just called the what about section. Like, what about Daniel? Or what about this reason to not do it or to see things differently? And we just don't have time to touch base on those. But I do want to address this one because it's important. Jesus in Matthew chapter 6 says, don't draw attention to yourself when fasting, as we understand it to be a place of pride. If we see fasting as a way that we think that we're earning something, either from God or from others. That is what he's speaking about in that passage. Now, I hope I've been clear on this. That's not what we do when we fast. Fasting is not about me earning or getting anything or asserting my ways. It is a response to who God is, to the circumstances of our life. And second, I want to be clear on this as well. Fasting is not a place of pride for me. I am no good at fasting. In fact, as we talked about this series and we were picking what habits we were choosing to do, I picked fasting and feasting, not because of this wealth of experience of it being a formative practice for me, because it hasn't been. And I was hoping that as learning, as studying this, that I would see a reason why it should be part of my life and that I could share it with you all to see why it should be part of your life as well. And we can do so understanding Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 6, when we recognize it's not a place of pride or a place of earning for us. And as we fast, we very much so should be telling each other what we're doing. We should be fasting together as a way to hold each other accountable, to be a source of encouragement, to help strengthen each other when we are calorie deficient. We should be fasting together, and I think we can do so while maintaining Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 6. So with all that said, let me show my plan that I did this past week. You can find better plans online. Again, this is a new thing that I'm learning into, growing in, but hopefully there's something here in helping this to be a process, a habit for you as well. I went one 24-hour period, dinner to dinner. I last ate on Thursday night, and then I went 24 hours, then I ate dinner on Friday night. And in those times that I would normally be eating, my stomach is reminding me, things are different, you're supposed to be feeding me, and so I'd have these physical reminders that something is going on. And I use those reminders to turn to God, to recognize that he is my greatest need in these. And so I prayed in these moments. And I gave myself specific prompts to work through because I was hungry and I needed something to keep my mind's attention. But even then, the prompts were really basic. It was first to look to God, then look to others, then look to my own life. So look up, look out, look in. And I did that once at breakfast, then another one at lunch, and then I did the final one right before I feasted at dinner. I broke my fast by feasting with Emily on Friday night. Now, it might not be helpful for you to break your fast with feasting. It's a really hard impact on your body after not eating for a whole day. It might be better to break a fast with something small, like a smoothie or something along those lines. But as I said, I'm still learning in this, and I was ravenous, and I was excited that I was done fasting. So it was the time to feast for me. I also did this on my day off, and I eventually want to move that to a weekday instead, because we say Sabbath and fasting are two different things. But I'm still learning in this, and I have a propensity to get angry when I'm hungry, and I didn't want that to happen when I am supervising the rest of the staff at Thornton or having pastoral care moments. That didn't feel like I was setting myself up well there. But I hope in showing all of this that the idea is not to create some rigid system that you must keep, do this week or else. No, it's just trying to show that there is a way to ease into this process of regularly fasting as we respond to the difficulty of life, the difficult events that show up, as we recognize in the midst of all of that, while we are waiting on Jesus' return, that our greatest need is our God, who is always with his people. And we can do the same thing with fasting. Again, to have this be a regular habit, something that shows up throughout our week. We have these times that we rejoice and remember our joys in God, but also to have these as events on the calendar that we do annually or every so often. And so in our household, we try to have something that brings us joy, that reminds us that our delight is in God. But then we do this on a bigger scale at different times throughout the year. As a life group, we get together and we have a potluck. Everyone contributes to the meal as people that we recognize God has brought us together. We've gone through difficulty together. We've rejoiced together. And we do so while feasting and recognizing our joy is found in him. Emily and I, we try to have the best meal that we have all year long on New Year's Eve. We save up for it so we can feast on this night, to look back on the year that was, to see how God's guided us through that, and look ahead to see what God might do in the next. Now, I do want to end our time this morning with a word of warning, that food can have an outsized place in our life, either in its avoidance or overindulgence. See, for some, food can be an idol, that it's a source of comfort for us. We find it hard, we turn to food when things are hard, or we find it hard to stop eating when things are going well. And if that's the case for us, we need to be really cautious when feasting. All the more reason to have people who know us with us so that they can be a help to us in this time. But other people physically cannot fast. This could be due to blood sugar issues or other medical needs, or maybe it brings back memories or tempts us to not withhold food, not for religious purposes, but for body image purposes. And then another example, so I mentioned that Emily feasted with me this past week, but she did not fast because she currently is a food source for a tiny person, so she's not able to. But I still think there's a way, even if we cannot give up food, to still get to the heart of what fasting is. It's in this time that we set apart for God to recognize our need for him, and so we make our meals look different. When we would be fasting, either it's a time that we set aside or people in our life are fasting and we're trying to join in with them, I think it starts off the same way. It's a directed prayer towards God. God, I cannot give this food up. Help me still to recognize that my need for you is greater than this meal. And so to use our actions then to make this mealtime different. We can't give it up so that we don't have that physical reminder of things being different, but we can be different in our actions to distinguish this time. I'm not at my desk. My phone is off. My computer is away from me. I'm focused on God because he is my ultimate dependence, even if I can't give up food. Now, I do want to push just a little bit on us. And to be clear, this is not medical advice. Please don't ever come to me for medical advice. I don't know, but acknowledging that this is not medical advice, where we can, let's not confuse something difficult as being impossible. Fasting and feasting are hard to do. It's hard to give up food when things are hard. And it's difficult to remember who the provider is when all we see is the bounty of food in front of us. And that's why we need these two practices, because they are ways that help shape us and form us to be more like Jesus. And here's the thing about being shaped. It hurts. It's painful. And we're reminded of that every time our stomach grumbles, but we miss it every time that we take a meal for granted. But instead, as we fast and we feast, these are ways that shape us and form us over time, not making things different overnight, but shape us and form us over time as it impacts our understanding of God, our bodies, the difficulty we go through in life, and the eagerness we have for Jesus' return. See, Jesus says, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world." And the way that we prepare for that first part, the trouble, and the way that we rejoice in the second part, that he has overcome, is by spending our days now marked by fasting and feasting. Now, there's one other meal, one other time that we gather together at the table, and that's when we do so to take the Lord's Supper or communion. And this is a meal that goes back to Jesus on the night before he was betrayed and arrested. He was with his disciples, and he was showing very clearly that this death was not some accident. It was not something outside of his power, but he was showing them what it was that he was about to do. And he took the bread that was at the table, and he broke it, and he said, "This is my body, which is given for you." So when Jesus goes to the cross, he's not overpowered, he's not against his will, but he does so willingly. He lays down his life so that we can live. He goes to die this death that he did not deserve so that we can have salvation that's found only in him. And if you're like me, there's all these questions of, yeah, but how can I know? How can I be certain? How do I know that he has done enough? Well, he took the cup. He said, "This is a new covenant. This is a promise." The binding part of it is not in how good you fast. It's not in how good you feast. It's not in how much you're working or trying to earn or anything. The basis of the promise, the basis of your salvation is my blood. This cup, the new covenant, is my blood poured out for you. And so when we take communion together, we rejoice in the fact that he has done it all. That we take the bread and the juice together, we are recognizing together as people joined together by God that he has made this way for us, that we have life because of him. And so from that, we live this life that he's called us to live. So in a moment, we're going to invite the people up who are helping with communion, and I'll pray. But let this be a time that we are slow down, that we embrace the silence, that we focus on what Jesus has accomplished, that he has paid it all, and we celebrate that when we take communion together. Let me pray for us as those helping with communion come forward. Father, we are so grateful that you have sent your son, that it's in him that we have life, that we have direction, we have guidance, that not just the basis for us to live, but you show us a way that's for our good and for your glory. As we take communion now, let this be a time for us to reflect anew and afresh on what it is that you have done for us. And there's still places in our life where we have turned away from you towards other things. And so let this be a time that we confess those sins to you before we take communion. So we do so recognizing that you are our life. You have given it to us. You guide us in it. And we want to live as you've called us to live. So it's to you and you alone we pray. Amen.